Up next, we have Jeremiah Grossman with Hacking Internet Websites from the Outside.
Thanks. Good afternoon. My name is Jeremiah Grossman. I am the founder and CTO of White Hat Security. Like was said, this is Hacking Internet Websites from the Outside. JavaScript malware just got a lot more dangerous. This presentation is an extension over last year's presentation entitled Phishing with Superbait. This extends what we can do with JavaScript. Before, we showed how dangerous clicking on links could be. Now we're showing how dangerous surfing the web can be. Before moving on into the actual presentation, a little bit about myself and my company. White Hat Security offers continuous vulnerability assessment and management services for websites. We are constantly assessing and penetration testing our customers' websites, looking for web application vulnerabilities such as cross-site scripting and SQL injection. I do lots of industry work in the community, but most of my time is spent doing technology R&D, industry evangelism, and one of the consortiums which I founded is the Web Application Security Consortium. Prior to founding White Hat, I was a former Yahoo Information Security Officer, where my job was to assess all of Yahoo's websites and find the vulnerabilities, resolve them before the bad guys exploited them. So this talk, you're going to hear lots about specifically cross-site scripting, which is now the number one vulnerability out there in the world. But to give you some background, we're going to cover some of the assumptions we have about intranet security. A lot of the assumptions that we have in the network security world, things that we can do on things that we can not be so diligent on the internet, things that we would not ever do on the public internet, such as leaving hosts unpatched, using default passwords, or not putting a firewall in front of hosts. These are things that we find acceptable or deem acceptable on the intranet, but never on the internet. The belief is that since we have perimeter firewalls that restrict traffic coming into the enterprise, that no one from the outside can touch these devices. What we're finding now is that these assumptions are wrong. These devices are directly accessible from the outside world with all the firewalls and encryption in place. We can actually begin to look at these and touch these devices on the inside. So when we talk about intranet devices, we're also talking about intranet devices with web interfaces. These days, most of our intranet devices, I would say, have web interfaces. Web interfaces are on our network printers, DSL routers, firewalls, IP phones, cameras, power supplies. This is where the nature of software is heading, web applications. And that's why you're going to see lots and lots of emphasis on web application security, both at this year's Black Hat and in conferences all over the world now. There's lots and lots of research going on in web application security because that's where the bad guys are looking. So what do we have on the inside of the intranet? We have also not only these devices, but we also have webmail systems, development machines, payroll systems. All the intranet web servers are now accessible. So what we're looking for is a platform that can attack these systems because we can't attack them through the perimeter. So how do we access these machines? This is a diagram of what would be the traditional perimeter security model. Everything in the blue, this would represent the intranet. Everything outside of the blue would be the internet. And as we can see, direct connections from the outside world into the intranet on ports such as SSH, NetBIOS, FTP, those are not allowed. They would be stopped by the firewall. But in the web world, what can happen is if an enterprise user, the person in green, was to visit a website that had something called JavaScript malware, that malware, that JavaScript malware, would be transported inside the firewall and be executed inside their browser. Now that the code is inside, the question becomes, what can JavaScript do? How can JavaScript access the intranet devices on behalf of an external intruder? So a little bit more information on what JavaScript malware is. This is a new term in the industry, JavaScript malware. It's the first time we're really talking about it. In the last year, there's been lots and lots of research going on as far as what we can do. Two things we want to keep in mind when we're talking about this. We want to keep in mind that JavaScript malware can get behind firewalls to attack the internet. And also, JavaScript is operating system and browser independent. It won't matter what browser you're using or what operating system you're using, they're all equally affected. Windows, Linux, BSD, OS X, all of them. We're going to be spending the majority of the talk doing demonstrations. The slides are for reference. All the source code to the demonstrations that I'm showing you is available on the CD. And if for some reason you didn't get the proof of concept source code, I will email it to you, or I'll make sure Black Hat does. What you'll find in the code is that we don't use any well-known exploits. There's none of the stuff you can patch against. We're using only plain JavaScript, cascading style sheets, Java applets, technologies common to all web browsers, or all popular web browsers, I should say. And at the bottom here is an important point. None of these demonstrations will require any use of Ajax. This is just plain browser technology that it's in every major web browser out there today. So one of the next questions we ask ourselves is, how, as a user, how do we contract JavaScript malware? How do we become infected? There's four main ways. The first one, the website owner could purposely put the embedded JavaScript malware onto their page. We see all sorts of malware on websites now, some purposely, some through defacements as a number two, but those are two ways how they can get on a website. Purposely or defacement, or through a defacement. Methods 3 and 4 have something to do with a vulnerability, again, cross-site scripting. The first number 3 here requires that the user is visits a page that has JavaScript malware on it that would have been put there by another user, a community-based website, for instance, a message board, a guest book, where the community purposely puts the code there, and if a user stumbles across it, it will automatically execute. The last way is also due to cross-site scripting, but to be infected requires a link click. The attacker would send a user a link, and they would have to click on it. This could be done over email, over instant message, or again, the link posted to a public website. The overall point is there's many, many ways to contract JavaScript malware, and it's easy to become infected. That'll be made more clear as we move forward. So the first method I'm going to show you is browser stealing, and I'm going to drop out of the slides now and go into actual demonstrations. One moment, please. Okay. My laptop is running several web servers. The first web server is Victim. This is our vulnerable website, the one that's vulnerable to cross-site scripting. This could be any one of 92 million websites out there in the world. It could be a bank, auction, e-commerce website, but this is our example. Tab 2, this is the hacker's web server where we're going to where we store our JavaScript malware, the code that we're going to use to do the demonstrations, the proof of concept code. So one way we look to spot, so for those unfamiliar with cross-site scripting, this will be a little bit of a reference relearning. One of the most notorious spots we find cross-site scripting is in the search fields on websites, since they echo user-supplied content. We will hit enter, and as we can see, the search term that we entered became part of the URL and also part of the response HTML. Echoed here, here, and here. We can start crafting our malicious URL, the URL that a user might click on. So, for instance, we'll retype in testing, and now we get 3 echoes for testing. So one of the first things we do with cross-site scripting is we see if we can put in JavaScript and make the website echo it back to the user. This is how we craft our malicious URLs. So now this is our malicious URL up here. If we hit enter, we'll get our JavaScript alerts. This is proof of concept that that we have a cross-site scripting vulnerability here. If we were to email this link to a user and they clicked on it, remember, if this came from a web bank, it would have the same URL. That's the power when this is tied with phishing. And when we look on links and try to spot phishing emails, usually the link that we click on is on an off-domain URL, not the genuine website. But in the case of cross-site scripting, it is the genuine website. So, but alerts, nothing dangerous about alerts, but let's see if we can get more sophisticated attacks to go in. For instance, we were left with stealing history. And what we found is that JavaScript can access APIs, development APIs from cascading style sheets. So the way this works is that JavaScript will make a long list of links in the web page that are invisible. And then check the color of those links in the browser. So if the user has never been there, it will be blue. If they've been there, it's purple. It's very easy to do this type of check. So here's our list of websites we're going to check. This is a US-centric for US users, but it could be applied to any website in the world. And this line here is what actually gets the color of the link in question. So we're going to copy the source, the URL source of this proof of concept code. This could be hosted anywhere in the world, anywhere in the world the hacker can post the code. So now we'll start crafting our malicious URL to source in that JavaScript from an off-domain location. For instance, right now we're in victim's domain, but we're going to request the JavaScript code from the hacker domain. We hit enter, and we immediately get our list of all the links. If you notice on the left, the ones that say not visited, our browser's never been to, if we have visited, it'll be in red. So if a malicious website owner or somebody else that was cross-site scripting a page, they could easily steal your history as far as where you've been to on the web. So I'm going to try to connect to the wireless. Maybe not. We're going to see if we can connect to the internet from the browser. Maybe not. One moment. We don't have internet connections here. That's okay. Okay, so that's the history and stealing example. Let's go back to the slides, and I'll show you what it looks like. Okay, so as we saw, this was the screenshot from the page where our browser has been to. If we had internet access, we could have clicked on one of the links, reloaded this page, and it would have showed up red again. So again, if you want to try this on your own machines and your own browsers, the source code is available. The next demonstration let me go back and try one more demonstration before we move on to IP addresses. We're going to try code such as browser spy. Since we're cross-site scripting a user's browser, it's helpful to know what type of browser they have. So we'll substitute steal history for browser underscore spy JS. So this is a very simple code. Most banner providers, people that supply advertising banners use this code a lot, but it'll tell you the type of browser, the user agent, screen resolution, color depth, the plugins that you're running. It tells us a lot of information about the type of browser. This is helpful when exploiting a user. Okay, so slides. Now that we know the user's browser and we know where they've, now that we've controlled the user's browser, we've gotten them to click, we've cross-site scripted the user. We know where they've surfed, what sites they visit, and also what types of browsers that they have. The next step is to start understanding their internal network. To do that, we want to get their internal IP address. The way we do that is through an applet that's freely available. It's by Lars Kinderman. It's called My Address, and this is what we'll be using. It will it has the capability to get internal NATed IP addresses, take that data, and pass it to JavaScript where we can act on it. Unfortunately, since we don't have the wireless isn't working for, we're having a tough time with the demonstration, but there's two ways to actually get the IP addresses. The second way is we can guess. Most internal networks are on 192.168.10 networks, but there's two ways. The IP address with applets works out very well. Okay. Okay. So we have internet access. So now we're going to try our code, the IP underscore address code. This will automatically load an applet on the public internet. IP underscore address and hit enter. So now what has happened here is that the applet is automatically loaded, shows my external IP address in the web page so JavaScript can access it, and also my internal IP address. So the connection out, that's the 211 number, and I also have the intranet one here. At the end of the URL has been rewritten to carry this information. The URL that we made has now been appended with the IP addresses we need to carry forward the attack. So to recap, we now know the user's browser, we know their surfing habits, and we know their intranet IP addresses. The next step is to start using the user's browser to move deeper into the network. So this is where we move on to JavaScript port scanning. It's very new, very cutting-edge exploits. Because of the browser security model, we don't have AJAX requests. Due to the security of the browser, AJAX requests cannot be made off domain. However, since we're not using AJAX, we're going to use a trick with script source equals to intranet locations on the 192.168 networks. What happens here is if a web server is listening, it will respond with HTML. When it does, that HTML will load and try to execute in the JavaScript interpreter, causing an error. Using this method is important because when you script source equals, you can't read the data that came back. We use a side channel attack to see if we got an error. If there was an error, then a web server was present. So we're going to try an actual demonstration of it here. So I'm going to go back. Port underscore scan. So we're going to move out our code from IP address to port scan. And hit enter. Okay, this code is nearly identical to the IP address code, except we have a new button, port scan. We're going to make this window smaller since I'm going to show you the debugger as port scanning takes place. Okay, this is the JavaScript console. As we port scan, we'll see the error messages. I don't know how many web servers are running on this particular network range, but we'll see what happens. So notice the JavaScript console. The Firefox console. It's actually making my browser send connections to the intranet. You'll see it update as new connections are being made. So it'll move up the range. This error here says there's a web server running on 77.20. I don't know. My intranet IP address is 7720, so it found me. If there's other web servers running on the network, it'll show up, but I might be the only one. One of the tricks that we had to overcome is browser timeout. When making off-domain connections to IP addresses that don't exist, the browser will hang for about 30 seconds. To prevent that, we used window.stop in JavaScript, which immediately cuts all the connections, which increases our speed in port scanning. So the port scan is almost done. And again, I'm the only one that it found, but it shows proof of concept that we're able to port scan the range. To show you an example what it looks like on a more of an enterprise network, this is a sample of when we ran this code on the White Hat corporate network. It was finding all of these web servers, and it had all the errors on the console. But this is what it looks like.
Those are the trickers, not just web servers, right?
I'm sorry?
You were saying those are more than just web servers. Those are embedded devices.
Those could be anything. Jeff's question was, what are these, really? We're only port scanning on port 80. We can port scan on most ports except a limited set, but we're really just looking at 80 and 443. And we don't know yet what these are. could be development servers, could be payroll systems, could be printers, routers. We don't know yet. But the next trick, we're going to show you how to identify these devices blindly. Does that answer your question, Joe? So now that we can port scan the network to make sure our attacks are smarter, we would like to know what the web server is. So again, due to the browser security restrictions, off-domain requests that we force the user to make, JavaScript doesn't have access to the response HTML. So we need another method. So the way we do that is with unique URLs. What we do is, after we find the web server, we force the browser to create image DOM objects to the IP address looking for unique URLs, such as Apache GIFs, HP printer logos, PHP Easter eggs. What happens is that the trick is the on-error event handler. If a response comes back from the web server, if it is an image, if this image actually came back, meaning that was the device that we're checking, there will be no error. If there was an error, that means that the image we check for, that's not the device. So we're looking for a lack of errors in this case for fingerprinting versus we're looking for errors in port scanning. So this is using blind URL fingerprinting. There are other techniques that we're experimenting with cascading style sheets or unique cascading style sheets in JavaScript. If we include these using JavaScript, we could check for the existence of objects in memory from JavaScript to see if those exist as well. Okay, at this point, we have everything we need to start attacking the user's browser or their intranet network. We know the user's browser, we know their surfing habits, we know their IP address, we know the web servers on their intranet, and we even know what types of web servers they are. The next step is attacking those particular web servers. We first need to get full control over the user's browser. And the way we're going to do that is with the zombie exploit code. This is a compilation of all the exploits rolled together. Now, once this interface I'm showing you here is a web server that I'm going to use, a website that I'm going to use to control browsers remotely. So what happens when I load the next exploit code in, browser is going to automatically and persistently connect to the master server. Think of a botnet in JavaScript. And we're going to capture its information here. So we're going to swap out the code once more. And we'll do zombie and hit enter. Several things will happen instantaneously. The first one is that I want to show you is that as soon as we loaded this code in, we're automatically port scanning. The next thing you'll see is the red outline here. This gives us persistent control over the browser. This is a full screen iframe overlaid over the page. The original web page has been deleted. So when the user clicks, if they click, they will stay within the threat of control. So now the hacker has a persistent access to them. If we view the zombie interface, all the data that the user has sees, all their cookie information, has now been sent to the zombie master server. This is running a SQL database, and this is the web front end to it. So this is, let me put this to another window. Okay, this is how we control the user's browser. This is their session number, their external IP address, their internal IP address. This is how we command the browser to do different things. We know all about the user, their user agent, all the stuff I showed you before, their history, everything we need to know. So now we can remotely control them. So let's say we wanted to force them to log in. We put in our redirect code. And say, force their browser to go to another page. This is the code that does that. We hit send. And their browser automatically gets sent to another page. Any page that we'd like. We could send them to Yahoo, their web bank. But in this case, we're sending them to the administration interface, to the blog software. So they now log in. This code has also been fitted with a keystroke recorder. So now they log in. And now they're logged in. This is to the back-end interface. Let's say we hit reload. So now we can see the keystrokes that they entered to log in. So we send them to a page, and now we can monitor everything that they type. Everything that they type, every place that they visit, all their history, everything that we need. So let's say we wanted to send them messages. Or let's redirect them back to the main page first. We'll send them back to the main page. Let's see if that works. Okay, so now we finally redirect them back to the main page. Now let's send them messages. Let's talk to the user. We can do alerts. Hello, Black Hat. We could start sending them messages, anything we want to send to them. We can also alter the text on the page. So let's say this was a media organization news for news. We can update the content on the page. So instead of myspace.com, we'll do text substitution, so now it says whitehatsec.com. So we can change news stories. We can completely control the user's browser, make them see anything that we'd like. Keep in mind that we're still on the victim website. We're not on the fake website. We're on the real website, so the user will believe that it's real. Let's say we want to make the code more invisible. We can make the frame invisible. No more red. So we can do anything we want that we'd like at this point. Now, again, we know everything about the network. We have persistent control over the user's browser. So now we want to start hacking the intranet. So connected to this laptop here, there is a DSL router. On 192.168.10.1. And it will ask me for a password. Now, web application security talks are normally about source code and different things like that, but I brought with me DSL router. The interesting part about these DSL routers, and I just bought this one before I came, is that there's default usernames and passwords on the bottom. This one happens to be username admin, password equals password, which is quite common in the industry, for some don't even have passwords. So we're going to type in username and password. So now this is the DSL router. So let's say, for our demonstration purposes, that we port scan and we found the DSL router and then we're able to fingerprint it. Say you're a home user, or this could be a firewall in the enterprise, but this is just one example. One of the interesting settings is something called WAN setup. So this there's something called default DMZ server that you can set. So if you read this, it says specifying a default DMZ server allows you to set up a computer or server that is available to anyone on the internet for services you didn't define. They even tell you there are security issues with doing this, so only do this if you're willing to risk open access. So we're going to make this full screen. One second. So I made a new tab. This demonstration sometimes has problems, but I'll try to walk you through it. This is the WAN setup where you can set up the default DMZ server right here. The way you do it is you just punch this in. You do 192.168. My IP address, if you want to open up the machine you've cross-site scripted to the world, 77.20. And hit apply. And this will self-update. So that's how it's supposed to work. So how can we make it force the user on the inside? So remember, that's it. So how can we have the user do this for us? These IP addresses, the 192 IP addresses, are private. We can't, a hacker, an external person, can't directly access these. But they can force the web browser to do it if they know what they're doing. So if we reload this page, go back down to WAN setup, it should have been on 7720, but it didn't apply. Oh, because we're not able to. So it's reset it to 1010 to 1020. So we want to start making requests, have the user start making requests on the hacker's behalf to force the DMZ to change. So I'll show you in the slides how this is done. It's easier to see that way. So before I do that, we'll use the code here to open up an iframe so we can see it. We're going to force the user to a new page. The actual DSL router IP. So we'll hit send. And now, over the previous web page, we see the Netgear interface. So now we can start forcing the user to make requests to the Netgear on the hacker's behalf. So let's go back to the slides and I'll show you how this is done. So I showed you the zombie code. And we've been able to authenticate default passwords. And we're going to skip the next couple slides. This will all become clear in a moment, but we're going to move on to the DMZ hacking. So when we do an update to the DMZ, we send a post request to the security.cgi, and the information that we filled in the forms gets sent across the wire. So we saw an update of 10 right here. So the next thing we do is we convert the post request to a GET request. The post data here, we move up to the URL and make a full URL like this. And this is the request we want the user to send. So there's one other trick. I wish I could show you the whole thing live, but the setup isn't working quite right. But what we would do is change this here, and the exact request that we needed to update the DMZ. Now that we know what the device is, where it is, we can also make them, force them to authenticate. So let's try that first. So we're authenticated, so I'm going to de-authenticate from the server. Okay, so I remove that. So now we are no longer, the browser is no longer authenticated to the DSL router. So I'll show you how to force it to authenticate, force the user to authenticate to that router using the default password. So we're going to force the new iframe. Let's, we have this here, okay. I will clear this page. Okay, we will clear this page and let's see. One moment, please. So I'm making sure I have the right session. Sorry for the delay. One moment, please. Okay, there we go. Okay. Now we want to force the user to log in to the DMZ router. So again, we are not authenticated to the DMZ router. So how do we force the user to auto-authenticate? So we'll use the redirect code. And we'll go admin:password. That's the default username and password at the proper IP, and we'll hit send. And it should work. Yep. So now we force the user to authenticate to the DMZ router. So now any request that we can force them to send, we can update the DMZ settings. It's just what request do we need. So this is these are the steps that we take to build the requests. We can do the research on our own, but we can build the request just by following the normal flow and how the website is supposed to operate. Converting post to gets is pretty simple. So at this point, to cover where we've been, we have cross-site scripting, persistent control over the user's browser. We know the browser. We know their surfing habits. We can port scan internally, force the user to make authenticated requests to any device on the network, which we have a default password to. We can literally do whatever we want because the browser, the internet browser, anybody on the internal enterprise is somebody we can use to hack internally. Consider the risk that you could be fully patched, have firewalls, proper configuration, but if you have JavaScript turned on, running IE or Firefox, this is possible. Clicking on the wrong link, surfing a MySpace website, and all this is now possible. So one other quick example using the slides. You know, other malicious things you can do to a user is printer hacking. So we can force printers to make to change their names. For instance, this particular request. We use this particular request here to update the name of the HP printer to owned. So one URL, force, and this is on this device, it's not authenticated. One URL, and we can actually change the device name. What was interesting about this hack is that this here was cross-site scriptable. We could put JavaScript there. And that would mean anybody visiting the web page on the printer would get instantly cross-site scripted. Another one on the printer, which we were doing auto-firing of printer test pages. The printer has different test pages that you can do. We were following to find the request that would fire test pages, and we were creating simple web pages where you do image source equals this URL here, and the printer would automatically generate test pages in the background on the fly. So what are other things that you can do with JavaScript malware that are of interest? Whitehat has been doing lots of research into not this black hat, but the dark side of search engine optimization, such as they call it SEO, the science of boosting search engine rankings so people can show up higher in the rankings. We're finding that these people are actually using web hacks, specifically cross-site scripting, to alter search engine results. This will be a subject of a lot of interest in the coming years. You can also perform click fraud, distributed denial of service. For instance, if you cross-site script a lot of users, thousands of them, you can direct them all just like a botnet to send requests to any website in the world. Other interesting things you can do is if you really wanted to get somebody in trouble, you can force them to hack other websites, download illegal content. And since this is just JavaScript, there's no Windows installer. All the evidence would say that they did. Every log would say that they made those requests because there's no installer on the system. As soon as the user closes their browser, the proof of concept code vanishes. You could also force the user to send email through webmail, force them to comment on other people's blogs. You can tamper with web-based voting. And we've also found ways to de-anonymize people so you can see who and where they're from, even if they're coming through anonymizing proxies, because we have control over the browser. We have the platform that they're running. We know what they're using. So now that we've seen how dangerous JavaScript malware can be, we're going to start visiting more about how users are able to become a victim. What does this mean? How risky is this? Are these attacks? What we're finding is that visiting trusted websites, is actually more dangerous than visiting what might be malicious websites or promiscuous web surfing. We'll get to more of that a little bit later. But all these attacks that we've been showing so far leverage cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery, two of the most, if not the most, widespread vulnerabilities out there in the world. We'll look at some numbers. So cross-site scripting attacks are everywhere. One thing you need to know about cross-site scripting is it attacks the user of a website, rather than the website itself. That's what makes cross-site scripting different. Security Focus has cataloged over 1,400 unique cross-site scripting vulnerabilities in open source and commercial software. White Hat Security looks at custom web applications, different software than Security Focus, and we found over 1,500 vulnerabilities. And our statistics are right around 7 in 10 websites, 70 to 80% of websites have at least one cross-site scripting vulnerability, but usually more like a dozen or more. Cross-site scripting also tops the web hacking incident database. This project tracks the media reported incidents of website hacking. So we'll get to more of those, but all the places where there's been a hack or a disclosure in a real live website, if it had to do with a web application, it's on the list. Cross-site scripting is now number one. Past cross-site scripting exploitation has shown up on PayPal, MySpace, which we'll get to, Circuit City, all sorts. Defacement, session hijacking, impersonation, worms, phishing scams. Cross-site scripting is very, very versatile, and it's the new attack that the bad guys are using. Cross-site request forgery, we'll start to hear about this more and more in the next year or two. But this attack isn't as well known, but it's just as dangerous. Cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery go hand in hand. Cross-site scripting is what gives you control over the user's browser. Cross-site request forgery is what allows you to make requests on the user's behalf. Unfortunately, we don't have any good statistics on cross-site request forgeries, but for the most part, just about every single website we come across, the functionality of that website is vulnerable to cross-site request forgery. So, two examples of cross-site request forgery in the real world. Where does it happen? A lot of it happens without our knowledge, but here's two real live incidents. In the U.S., there's a website called Dig. This website allows users to post what might be interesting news stories, and if other users like it, they can click that they like it, and popular news stories will rise to the top. What this person did was they created a blog webpage. And when you visited this web page, if you were logged into Dig, it would automatically make the request to Dig for you and automatically vote the story higher. And it showed up on the front page of Dig, and it got a lot of traffic because of it. It forced you to do something, the user to do something they didn't want to do, completely invisibly. This is another one that we found, White Hat found, on Google's Gmail, their webmail system. We found that there was a URL that you could request on Gmail. The response came back in JavaScript, but it contained your entire email contact list. So we created a demonstration web page that when you visited the web page, you would force your browser to make a request using script source equals, pull in the contact list into the demo web page, and show your contact list. If we wanted to, we could have stolen everybody's email contact list and use it for nefarious things. We disclosed it to Google, and they promptly fixed it. But these are the things we're talking about when we're talking about cross-site request forgeries. I believe Alex Stamos in the talk before talked a lot about the MySpace and the Yahoo Mail incidents. So I'll cover these just briefly. So the MySpace worm was a really big deal for web application security, because it showed what was possible on how JavaScript malware could spread and how fast. What Sammy did, the hacker, is he put code on his MySpace profile, and when users visited his profile, they would automatically become his friend, change their profile to say, Sammy is my hero, and then update their profile with a copy of his malware code. And in the span of just 24 hours, MySpace had about 35 million users at the time. But 1 million web browsers were infected in just 24 hours. From what we've seen in earlier demonstrations, imagine what Sammy could have done with complete control over 1 million web browsers. What would happen if he just said, everybody go to eBay, Bank of America, Yahoo. Just do nothing else but to visit those sites. No website in the world could handle 1 million simultaneous transactions. His goal was just propagation with no payload. And the same goes with no payload, just propagation. What happens when these types of attacks start actually getting more malicious? In my opinion, we're at the same point where we were in 1994 or maybe a little bit earlier with email worms, where the hackers were experimenting with propagation, how fast and the methods of spread without malicious payload. Now today, there's malicious payload in almost every piece of spam we're getting, it seems. So we're actually going in that direction with JavaScript malware. There's research being done on how JavaScript malware spreads, but how dangerous can JavaScript be once you have control over a user? If you're interested in reading more about more of the specifics behind the MySpace worm, I wrote a white paper with the URL here. It'll show you how web worms spread versus other worms, and you'll find it interesting. So now that we've seen all the attacks and how dangerous attacks are, the natural question comes up is, what do we do now? How do we protect ourselves? Or at least try. So to start covering it, let's look at what solutions are clearly not going to work. So we have lots of solutions in the marketplace, all of which are good for some things, but not effective at combating JavaScript malware. Patching an antivirus is not going to help. Corporate web serving filters, not going to help, because you're more likely to get affected surfing legitimate websites rather than malicious websites. Secure socket layer, cross-site scripting, and all these things will work over SSL just fine. Two-factor authentication, again, we're working with the real website, not fake websites, so this will work. So two-factor auth, it'll work just as well. And staying away from questionable websites also. I mean, this is fundamental to the web. These solutions are good for other things, but not for combating malware. So what do we need? The first thing we need is we have to look at security at two points. Security on the web server or the website and user security. Unfortunately, the browser security vendors have been slow at designing better browsers that can combat this threat. So here's my advice. This is what I do to protect myself. Watch out for overly long links, whether they're emailed to you or passed along or however you come across them. you'll notice that in the cross-site scripting links that we are building, they tend to be very, very long, and they contain HTML in them. Those are definitely the links you don't want to click on. If you're not too sure if a link is safe or not, what I do is I type in the domain name by hand. So if I get an email from that says it's my bank wanting for me to verify my username and password or my account information, I'll just type it in directly and then proceed to log in. That way there's no way the hacker could have got threat of control over my browser. If the bank wanted me to actually verify my account information, they would have asked me after I logged in. It's also our opinion that no browser has a clear security advantage over another. Having said that, I do prefer Firefox, if nothing else, to stay out of the way of the hacker's target. The hacker's been very active in hacking and exploiting IE, and that's the target that they're going after. Firefox has vulnerabilities just like every other browser, but there doesn't seem to be a focus on exploiting users using Firefox or Mozilla or Opera or whatever other browser you prefer to use. For additional security, there are extensions you can add to browsers that are very, very helpful. My new favorite is a recent one that came out of Stanford called Safe History. This prevents websites from stealing your history using the cascading style sheet hack that we showed earlier. This will keep your history safe. Now, you could turn off JavaScript in your browser, and this would help you a lot in combating all these threats. But it also might be inconvenient since a lot of websites all depend on JavaScript or having JavaScript. So what you can do is install this extension called NoScript. This gives you the ability to turn JavaScript and its different and its capabilities on and off depending on the website you want. So think of it as a firewall, a JavaScript firewall for your browser. And lastly, there's the Netcraft toolbar. I like this toolbar because it shows results. This toolbar is actually what found the cross-site scripting phishing scam on PayPal first. So this is definitely a good product. When in doubt, disable JavaScript, Java, and ActiveX, and I missed one, Flash, prior to surfing the web. If you need them from time to time, then turn them on. From my point of view, these solutions are still band-aids. There needs to be a larger solution in the browser. There needs to be better browser security models. And hopefully these demonstrations will help the browser makers develop stronger guidelines, stronger products. So this is why I'm advocating we need more browser security. So the solution that I like that has been recommended is something called content restrictions. This gives the website owner the ability to combat cross-site scripting by predefining what their website should do, what should execute, and in what part of the page. So if your website happens to be cross-site scriptable, if a good policy is in place as defined here, we should still be okay. But as of yet, no browser vendor has implemented this solution. We're hopeful that they will. On the server side, we have to prevent cross-site scripting. We have to prevent our websites from hosting JavaScript malware. And the best way to do that is rock solid input validation. 99 times out of 100, one line properly placed will save you lots and lots of headaches. This code right here, which is a regular expression, which can be ported to just about any major language, will filter the output, user-supplied output, and strip it from containing HTML. HTML, which is what makes JavaScript and cross-site scripting possible. By adding this code, you will render user-supplied input from getting echoed to the screen. You will render it safe, harmless. This is the code that you need. There's a lot more to learn about input validation, so I recommend do Google searches and different things like that. But this is the one line. It's really just one line. It will save websites the world over. And if you have sensitive functions on your websites, you want to protect them from CSRF, from cross-site request forgeries. You want to research implementations of session tokens, CAPTCHAs, and we used to think refer checking was good, but it's no longer. So these are the two solutions that we need to research and implement properly on websites. So, the high-level best practices. Find vulnerabilities in websites before the find and fix your vulnerabilities in websites before the bad guys do. One crucial point to understand is that web application security is different than network security. In network security, we can, for the most part, completely automate the process of finding vulnerabilities. We can't do that in web applications. Scanning websites for vulnerabilities will find maybe about half of the vulnerabilities, but the rest has to be done by hand. This is a computer science problem, the halting problem, that we cannot scan websites for all vulnerabilities all the time. We need human intelligence, expert-driven analysis. So if you really want to get a complete picture of your website security and find all the vulnerabilities, you want to combine both automation and the assessment process. So another solution out there for defense in depth is web application firewalls. And there's many varieties out there, both a lot in the commercial space. If you're running Apache, I'm highly recommending Mod Security. It has nice default rules for protecting against cross-site scripting, SQL injection, and many other attacks. It's freely available, and I never install Apache without it. This is a very good product. And the last piece of advice is that intranet websites are now at least somewhat accessible now to the outside world. They're not as accessible as publicly facing websites, but they are accessible. So if you have internal websites, I highly recommend patching them and changing their default passwords, especially on the DSL routers. For more recommended reading, these are three books that I have read. I've written the foreword for Preventing Web Attacks with Apache and Web Hacking Exposed. All three are great books, and you'll learn a lot. I definitely did myself still. And this is the I've come to the end of the presentation. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Are you able to get the usernames and passwords which are saved in the browser, eliminating the need for user typing actually the username and password through this browser hijack?
The keystroke recording?
Yes. No, not the keystroke, but using the password manager.
Yes. I have not personally. But I have heard of other guys that have had successfully doing it. It's still tweaky. They're trying it in Opera and Firefox and IE. It's not perfect all the time, but I hear they're experimenting with it. It's one of the areas of research I want to do more on.
This would automate the collecting password really much for Black Hat.
You're exactly right. I think the method that they're using is they're creating in the DOM lists of form input elements with different names that they might have typed in before, and it's automatic, and the browser will automatically fill them in, and then they'll grab them out that way. So it won't be, it's not like just grabbing the actual file. It's still a guessing game, but they have had decent results, and they're just looking for a password here and there. They don't need to get it perfect all the time. But yeah, definitely a good point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure speaking with you here. I hope everybody learned a lot.
Thank you.